بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Now we move to discuss a few issues during the minor occultation. The very fact that we have two different types of occultation. One occultation in which there was an access to the Imam through intermediary, the Nawab, and the other occultation which was the absolute disappearance of the Imam in a way that no one had access to him to ask questions or whatever, is something which was predicted by the Prophet, peace be on him, and A'imma alayhi wasalam, about the last Imam alayhi salam. And of course, there is a very rational philosophy behind it if we think about it. If Imam had just disappeared like that, then there would have been lots of doubts and suspicions and whether the Imam at all was there, was he an Imam, was he not an Imam. So this interim period, the 70 years of minor occultation, in which the Imam was in contact and was not in contact with the Shia community, was a sort of preparation for, first of all, establishing the idea that the Imam can be there without you being able to have contact with him, and the idea that you are going to be without an Imam after this for a long time. This was established somehow. However, establishing this idea was very difficult. To convince the Shia community that this is the case was very difficult, especially with the secretive nature of the whole event. A big cloud of confusion was going around among the Shia. As I said, you should not compare yourself with the Shia of that time. You are very lucky, you know a lot. You have lots of traditions, you have the benefit of the hindsight. They didn't have this. Many of them didn't even know that the Imam was born. Now, I have brought something at the beginning of our discussion here about what happened to Shia after the demise of Imam Hassan al-Askari. It was not just that nice and neat thing that you know. Now, here I have a book. This book is a very, very famous book. Of course, the English translation, Shia Sect, is translated by our college and published by our college. But the book is written by one of the relatives of the third Na'ib of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, Hassan ibn Musa al-Nawbahti. Of course, when we come to Hussein ibn Musa al-Nawbahti, we'll discuss about him, the family of Ali Nawbahti. This is one of the members of Ali Nawbahti. The book is written during the minor occultation. Around, say for example, 20-30 years after the disappearance of Imam alayhi salam, the book is written. Now, here Hassan ibn Musa al-Nawbahti says that after the demise of Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, the Shias were divided into 14 different divisions. This was unprecedented. After the demise of any Imam, there might have been disagreement, so 3-4 groups came up. But 14 groups was really amazing. And this shows the amount of confusion which was going on at the time of that period, the era immediately after Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. Now let's see what does he say. Now the thick cloud of confusion, of course, which was there. Going through this, one just cannot help themselves to appreciate and thank God that now we are not living in such a situation. And through what is troubling the faith about the 12 Imams, unleashed us. I mean, it was not just something very nice and neat coming through, unfolding in the history, no. It was a thorough struggle of A'imma and their companions to establish this, especially because there were many vested interests around, which were somehow trying to bend the current of events towards themselves. And that's why you see after each Imam, we had this division. For example, after Imam al-Sadiq, we had Fatahis, Nawusis, Ismailis, after Imam al-Kazim, we had Waqifis, and all these things, of course, all have died out, except for Zaydis and Ismailis. These are the faith inside Shia divisions which have remained. Otherwise, all these 14 factions, the factions before them, they have all died. But it was a real struggle of the Imams and their followers and companions to really somehow calm down the situation and impart this faith to us in this nice and neat way that we have it today, alhamdulillah. Now, Abu Muhammad Hassan ibn Musa al-Nawbakhti, or Nawbakhti, this is the man. We don't know when did he die, between 300 to 310, sometime around that time. And you know, the Mira quotation took place 260, and it extended until 329. For about 69 years or 70 years. So this is just in the middle of the minor confrontation that he has written the book. He was actually one of the companions of Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. He was present after the Imam's demise, and he was quite aware of the arguments and discussions which were going around among different factions. That's why, of course, very succinctly, but very nicely he had explained what happened after Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. So, in his book Shia Texts, or Firaq al-Shia, he says that after Imam al-Askari, the Shia were divided to 14 divisions. Now, what were these 14? Some of these divisions are very difficult to figure out what they were saying, because this is very, very old history. And he is very succinct. Some of them is difficult really to distinguish from others, but certainly there was something which he missed to write. And that's why we do not understand what some of these sects said. One sect said the 11th, well, not sects, divisions. The 11th Imam was alive and he was the Mahdi. Why did they say, anyone knows why did they say the 11th Imam is alive and he's the Mahdi? Because they were not aware of a son born of Imam al-Askari. So, that secretive birth, it was not just secret for the Caliphs or the Sunnis, it was secret for many Shias. When it is secret, it is secret. So, the Imam only disclosed this as much as it was necessary, so that it is not said that no child was born at all. However, the outer circle of Shia, especially those Shias who were somehow after their own vested interest, even when they were coming to Imam, they were completely unaware of such a child, a son born for Imam al-Askari alayhi salam, and therefore, what should they say? They say, no, Imam is alive, otherwise the Shia faith is dead. If there is no son, and if Hasan al-Askari is dead, then that means that's the end of Shia, that's the end of Imam. So they said, no, he is the Mahdi, and he's alive. Okay, they have vanished, of course, now. The other division, the 11th Imam died, and came to life after his death, and he was the Mahdi. This was more like a Christian, you know, the resurrection after the dead. Why they said he died? Because no one could deny that. Because the event in Samarra was witnessed not only by Caliph and the court, people of the court, but by anyone who was there, because Imam al-Askari was not a small figure. Although he was imprisoned, although he was in the garrison, in the barrack, however, on the point of his death, it is said in the history that the whole Samarra was mobilized to come to take part in the funeral. So it was very difficult to deny that Imam al-Askari had died. However, what would they say if there was no child, if there was no son after him? He was resurrected. Maybe not 3 days as Jesus Christ, but some days after his death he was resurrected and he is the Mahdi. This is the second. Now, of course, the people who were saying this were not just ordinary lay people. They were otherwise, I mean, what lay people say would not stick into the history books. Only those prominent people whose views are considerable, their views would remain in history. Otherwise, other rumors or just chapters of people, they would disappear. So there were important people around this Shia community in Samarra and other places that they were saying these things. The names, some of the names are there, which are not important because the views are there, the people are there, and it's not important to know now who said what. Now, the third view was that the Imam after Hassan ibn Ali is his brother Ja'far, who was designated by his brother. This, of course, was a long-standing view in Shia, that a brother could appoint a brother. The Shias usually believe that after Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam, designation go from father to son, not from brother to brother. However, here, the Fatahis, long-standing Fatahis, and the view of Fatahiyah, who believe that the Imam after Musa al-Kazim was Abdullah al-Aftah, and after him, he designated his brother Ja'far al-Sadr. And then the Imam continued with Ja'far al-Sadr descendants. They were still around, the views were around, and they said in the same way, the Fatahis, in the same way that Abdullah al-Aftah, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, the son of Imam Sadiq who appointed his brother Musa al-Kazim. The son of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam appointed his brother Ja'far. Here, Hassan al-Askari appointed his brother Ja'far as well. So we have two Ja'far appointed by their brother. Now, however, this view was very difficult to accept by the majority of the Shia because Ja'far was a licentious person. No one could have believed that Ja'far could be an Imam. Therefore, this was a very, very minority circle. Others had other views. So this is the third view. And of course, Ja'far did many evil things immediately after the claiming Imam for himself that everyone dispersed from around him. The fourth view was that the Imam after Hassan ibn Ali is his brother Ja'far, who was not designated by his brother, who was designated by his father. Therefore, Imam al-Askari was an imposter. So he claimed Imamah for himself, Ja'far remained silent until al-Askari alayhi salam died, and then Ja'far claimed Imamah as it belonged to him. So they were against Imam Hassan al-Askari right from the beginning. Now, the fifth group, neither Hassan ibn Ali nor Ja'far ibn Ali were Imams. But the Imam was their brother Muhammad ibn Ali, who had died in his father's lifetime, and he is the Mahdi. Now, this is very interesting. So, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam had three sons. Muhammad, Ali, Hassan, Muhammad, Hassan, and Ja'far. Now, Hassan and Ja'far, they claimed Imamah, but they were not Imam. The Imam was Muhammad, who had died before them, and he was the Mahdi, and he will come back. Now, of course, if we want to analyze the history, we can find out why these sort of factions were fighting with these type of views. I mean, some accepted Ja'far, some were rejecting both Ja'far and Hassan, some were accepting both Ja'far and Hassan in a different way. So, to go into the depth of it, we can analyze why historically they have said these things. Now the sixth group, the 11th Imam openly had a son, whom he named Muhammad, and he is the Mahdi. Now this was very difficult to say, because he never had openly a son. The son was quite a secret issue, which was not known, but they just wanted to establish that there is a Mahdi who's son of Imam al-Askari, and they used to say, no, he openly had a son. Imam al-Askari had a son who was born 8 months after his death, and he is the Mahdi. Those who say that he had a son during his life are liars. Now this is probably due to the fact that after his demise, one of her slave maidens, who of course was his wife, just to protect the Mahdi alayhi salam, she said that I'm pregnant. And therefore all the focus was on her. And she was kept under surveillance to see when this child was going to be born. But after 8 months, this revolt of the black slaves happened, and the whole attention of the court was taken towards them, and the lady was relieved. And these people said, the lady, when she was released, she gave birth to that child. And that child is Mahdi alayhi salam. Why they said that? Because it was not proven for them that Mahdi was born at the time of Imam Hassan al-Askari. They said, we don't know anything about it. Imam did not tell us anything. He had told other people, so that's their conviction that they have to follow. The eighth group say the Imam had no son at all. They don't say anything. But now, here Mubassid doesn't say anything about anything more than that. And we don't know what really these people said. The ninth group, the Imam had terminated by the death of the 11th Imam. The earth is left without an Imam until Allah wills to send Al-Mahdi. Now, this was a complete revolt against the Shia belief that the earth cannot be left without an Imam. Now, they had long justifications. They said, yes, the earth cannot be left without an Imam unless the sins grow. And because the sins have grown, Allah had withdrawn the Imam, the Hujjah, from the earth, and therefore there is no Hujjah until the day when Mahdi comes. And we don't know who the Mahdi is, whose son Mahdi is going to be. The other group were Nafisiyah. These were the following of a servant called Nafis. Now this is a very interesting view. Imam al-Hadi designated his son Muhammad, not Hassan. Muhammad who had died in his lifetime. When Muhammad was dying, he could not designate his father again. He was the Imam, he was designated Imam. But he was dying, he couldn't designate his father again. There was no one to designate. So, he designated a young servant called Nafis and transferred all the bequests to him and asked him to give them to Ja'far should anything happen to his father. This is a very convoluted way of argument, of course. It's very difficult to understand on what basis these were said. And they had long arguments. For example, they said when Husayn ibn Ali was leaving for Karbala, for Kufa, he left all the bequests of Imama to Umm Salama to give it back to Imam Zain al-Abidin after he comes back from Kufa. And the same thing was here. Of course, neither Nafis is comparable to Umm Salama, nor Ja'far is comparable to Imam Husayn alayhi salam, but they made all these sort of arguments for their cause. And therefore, Nafis was an interim sort of Imam, a trusted person to whom the whole issue of Imam was trusted, and he gave it to Ja'far. The 11th group, they don't know who the Imam is after Al-Hassan, although they believe there should be an Imam. It was a good, of course, very right, nice and neat. We don't know who the Imam, that's all. Now, the 12th group, he said that they were the main Shia. And he brings lots of arguments in their favor, because he was of the main issue, of course. What we believe now. He says that why they believed in such and such, what were the proofs, what was the evidence, and all these things he mentioned. The imamah was transferred to Ja'far after al-Hasan al-Askari because he had no progeny, not because brother could, it was just out of exigency. And the 14th proof, the imam after Imam al-Askari is his son Muhammad, and he is the awaited Mahdi. However, he died, and he will return one day to fill the earth with justice. We don't know again why they said this. Maybe they just wanted to cover, to protect, or whatever. We don't know. Now, why I mentioned all these useless issues here, just to somehow put ourselves in the context of the Nawab, of the time of the Nawab, and how could they deal with such an environment with such very, very bitter trends, and they were really fighting each other for me. How could they calm down the situation and establish that yes, Mahdi was born, he is in hiding, he will come one day, and you know, all these other 13 have now completely disappeared. It's only that one issue, which was certainly the issue of the idea that Mahdi was born and he is in hiding, which remains. Now, I want to ask you one question. In such a cloud environment, how did the Deputies manage to establish them? Very difficult. Can you imagine an answer for this? You know, still we have today people, Shias, who say that this whole idea of deputies and these things is just a fake sort of story made by the Nawab, the idea of Mahdi, born, being in hiding, made by the Nawab, so that they collect homes for themselves. Of course, the denial of the Imam meant that everyone would take the homes to them, isn't it? And the homes was quite a considerable amount of money at that time. At the time of Al-Qadi alayhi salam, only the homes of Bahrain for one group of people in Bahrain, one of the wakala of Imam al-Hadi was bringing the homes of Bahrain, was 80,000 dinars. That was a lot. And that shows how Shias were great in number and wealthy people. So, this whole idea of being a Nama'ir meant that, of course, all these homes were coming to them. And they had to pump that, certainly, with the permission of the Imam, into the Shia community. But what if it is all a story? It was not just, it was not pumping into the Shia community. It was just, they were collecting the homes for themselves. And they made up the whole story to say that, to convince people to bring them this money. What do you say? What's the answer to this? So you accept it. Well, the answer is, they were not the only people who were after the home, if they were after. There were all these 14 factions, first of all. And the Shias were not fool people to bring their homes to people not knowing what they were doing. And the scholars around the world were not just a stupid ulama, so to speak, to encourage people to take homes to these people without knowing what is behind it. And therefore, it is very, very hard or silly for a person to say such a thing. It's insulting all those scholars, intelligent people, ministers, wazirs, and all these people who were around as Shia at that time, just thinking that they were so fools to give their homes to anyone who claimed the naib of the Imam. That's one issue. If you go to the internet, Al-Qasib and others, you see these people are spreading these views, certainly. However, what is important here for us is that what the strategy these Mubah took to establish the mainstream idea that all these other groups are wrong. Of course, they were not bellicose coming out fighting or something like that. All these discussions were secretly going in the Shia network, underground network. Shia underground network is not something that's appearing on the surface. How could they convince all other factions? And certainly, of course, great Shia scholars, they were unanimous accepting their authority. Except six of them that we will discuss, who claimed the deputyship for themselves. Well, it is said there were six. There were certainly less than some of them. Their claim for deputyship is exaggerated in the sense that they said something else and people said that you are claiming deputyship for the Imam alayhi salam. So, there was this consensus. This is very important. This consensus among all Shia scholars. Scholars were very important because they were not people to be fooled by emotions. As soon as someone saying, I am in contact with the Imam, or I am the Naib of the Imam, they accept it and say, yes. Like some of our youngsters today, they just get fooled by some people saying, we are in touch, or we are in great sort of spiritual contact with some Mawadi of the Imam, so to speak. These scholars were really tough. I mean, you read some of their books. They did not accept things just on the basis of a tradition or something heard here or someone said something there. No, they were really following the evidence and truth. So the very fact that the scholars had the consensus shows it's an evidence that they were true. These Mubah. It was very difficult because you see, when I claim that I'm in touch with the Imam and no one else can go and ask him whether this man is your Naib or not, it's very difficult to prove this claim. So they should have had real evidence that we are the Nawab of the Imam so that the scholar would have accepted that yes, you are right. We accept, we agree that you are in contact with the Imam, although we cannot go to him and ask him whether you are a Naib or not. So the task was very complicated, confounded, and difficult for these Nawab. Now, some reports indicate that for about 2 years after the demise of Imam al-Askari, still the Shia referred to Imam al-Askari's mother, and not because the Naib had not yet established himself. The first Naib had not yet established himself. So still they were looking for another source to listen to as a mediator between them and the Imam. Now, of course, Imam Askari's mother, Khudayn, or Susan, of course, you know the ladies had a name before marriage and after marriage, one name after marriage, and this was a habit. So that's why all wife of Aimma, the Prophet, they had two names, one name before marriage and one name after marriage. So then Khudayn should be the name before marriage, Susan should be the name after marriage. For marriage issues, and Sheikh Saduq reports from Ahmad ibn Ibrahim saying, I visited Hakima. Hakima was the aunt of Imam al-Askari, daughter of Imam al-Jawad, in the year 262. This is 2 years after the demise of Imam al-Askari and the beginning of the minor occultation, and talked to her from behind a veil. I asked her about her views regarding the Imams. So this Ahmad ibn Rahim still is looking for the truth to find out what is the reality about this issue of Imam. And she named them one by one, including Al-Hujja ibn al-Hasan al-Askari. I asked her, where is this son now? And she said, he is in hiding. I said, so the Shia should turn to who? If he is in hiding, who should we go and ask our question? She said, to the grandmother, Jadda. And that's why this Jadda, the Jadda means grandmother. And you come across this Jadda in many traditions, that people actually referred for many issues to Jadda. And this was just like, as we said, people were referred to Zainab Salamullah alayha, for example, after Hussein for a while, until Imam Zainul Abidin was well and established himself. And now people refer to Jadda until the first Na'ib could establish himself. And of course, these Na'ibs were supported by Jadda, they were supported by Hakima, they were supported by close relatives of the house of Imam al-Askari, except for Ja'far, of course. And this was another evidence for the people that these were the truthful Nawab of Imam alayhi salam. She added that this was an order from Imam al-Askari following the example of Al-Hussein alayhi salam. As I said, Al-Hussein alayhi salam referred everyone immediately what to do immediately after his demise, his martyrdom, to refer to Zainab alayhi salam. So Hakima says Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam has done the same thing, referring everyone to his mother until things are established, the clouds of confusion are away. Now, Jadda had this role until the first people of Umar ibn Sa'id established themselves. Apart from the opinions on the imamah, there were additional disputes about the deputy. However, the clouds were cleared gradually. Now, the four deputies who undisputedly could establish themselves. When I say without dispute among the scholars agree, the evidence they provided was sufficient for them, that they were the deputies, without them being able to refer to Imam alayhi salam as he was in hiding. The four deputies of the Imam in the period of minor occultation were Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri al-Samman, who was already a representative of the 10th and 11th Imam. So he was a very respectful Shia personality. There were occasions where Imam al-Hadi and Imam al-Askari were asked about a trusted person on whom Shia could rely and to whom they could refer, and they had referred them to Uthman ibn Sa'id, actually preparing, in the hindsight we can understand, preparing the Shia to respect this man as a deputy of Imam. Then his son Muhammad ibn Uthman ibn Sa'id, who died 305, he was the author of a number of books in Fiqh and Hadith, which he reported from the 11th and the 12th Imam, and also from his father. Then we have Hussein ibn Ruh al-Nawbakhti and Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samuri, who was deputy only for 3 years, and he was the last deputy. Now, the most important and crucial role, the L is missing here, of the deputies was to establish the idea of occultation, that the Imam can be there, but the Shias could not see him. This was very important. As I said, if we just jump into the major occultation, it was very difficult to find out what has happened. Here, in this interim 70 years, the idea of occultation gradually was absorbed by the Shia, that this can be the case, that they can live without an Imam, although the Imam is there. But of course, as I mentioned before, even the period of Imam al-Hadi and Imam al-Askari was a perpetual period, that there was very, very limited access to them. However, here there was no access at all in this interim time, unless through a representative and intermediary. And therefore, this was a very crucial moment for Shia, period for Shia, to establish the idea of occultation. Why was this period needed before the absolute disappearance? Well, I answered the question. I just wanted to ask you, but I have rushed answering it also. Now, other more routine responsibilities of the deputy were to act as mediator between the Imam and the Shia, taking the correspondence to the Imam and bringing the answer, collecting the khums, pending it under the orders of the Imam, how this should be pumped to the Shia community at the time, and just these routine responsibilities that they had. However, you can imagine at that time where Imam was not accessible, of course they took, assumed the role of the heart of the community, the Nawab. So it was a very great task. And it makes the whole scenario more attractive, knowing that all these things were going in secret. I mean, no one in Baghdad knew, except those close circle Shias, what is the meaning of a Na'ib? Who is the Na'ib? No one knew. I mean, they were living just as ordinary people. They had their own businesses and all these things. No one knew about it. This is a very attractive sort of a story when we look into it. The secrecy side, and then the challenges that they face, the way they prepare the community. Now, this mediation created its own language. It's very interesting. Now we use many jargons about Imam al-Asr, which was created at that time. A number of terms were coined to refer to the Imam and his correspondence, because of course they couldn't just, I mean, he was, if Uthman ibn Sa'id was sitting in his shop, for example, someone coming and telling him, take it to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. That was the end of Muhammad ibn Uthman and all the Shia communities there. So they had to have a secretive sort of terminology for themselves to use among each other. Now the terminology are very familiar for you now, it's not secretive at all. When they are said, we know what is meant by it, but at that time it was quite a sort of exclusive type of language. As-Sayyid, Al-Alim, these were the terms they used to refer to Mahdi alayhi salam. So when they say Al-Alim, of course everyone could have thought this is an Alim in Baghdad or in Samira or whatever. An-Nahiyatul Muqaddasah. Now we say Ziyaratul Nahiyah, isn't it? We have Ziyaratul Nahiyah. Nahiyah means direction. And that is, we mean direction of the Imam, but they just use this direction. Okay, can you take this to direct to the direction? Okay, no one knew what it meant. Can you take this to a Nahiyah? No one meant. Al-Gharim. The Gharim is someone to whom you owe. And because they owe homes to Imam, especially when it came to money and business, they called Imam Al-Gharim. So you owe to him, you have to pay your homes to him. He was also called As-Sahib. Now, when we say As-Sahib, all of us know what it was meant by. But at that time, not many people knew what is meant by As-Sahib, the companion, for that. Sahib al-Dar, owner of the house. Sahib al-Asr, the companion of the time. Waliyul Aqd, Waliyul Amn, these were the sort of terms. His letters were called At-Tawqi', which simply means signature. Now, At-Tawqi' has come from the Nahiyah. Now, you see, this is a very secretive language, isn't it? A signature has come from the direction. Now, if you are not aware, if you are not into the inner circle of the Shia, you don't understand what does it mean. A signature has come. And by signature they meant the letter which has the seal or the signature of the Imam on it. And this was a very important issue because these deputies were bringing the letters of Imam. And the letters should have been in Imam's own handwriting. The scholars demanded that. That whenever you ask for something, you bring us a letter from Imam. We want it to be in Imam's handwriting. And how did you know what was the Imam's handwriting? Now, these scholars were very clear, clever, as I said. They were not to be fooled very easily. They had letters from Imam al-Ashari. And the letters, they said, if Imam could produce letters with his handwriting, we accept. Otherwise, we don't. And these Tawqiyat came with the handwriting of the Imam to them. And it was in that way that they believed that this is from the Imam. Of course, sometimes there was not a Tawqiyat coming from the Imam. The answers came from the deputies themselves. And you see, it was due to the status of the scholar as well. Sometimes the scholar was not so lucky to get the direct answer from the Imam. The deputies just conveyed the answers. One of the scholars, I don't remember his name now, he asked something, he wrote a letter to the Imam through the deputy and he wanted a response and it was delayed. Someone advised him, don't be sad, this is good, because that means the Imam is going to answer the letter rather than the deputy himself. And this delay is because probably the Imam is not available at the moment, the deputy cannot see him now, and that's why the answer is delayed. Now, all these terms were coined because of taqiyya, of course, as I said. It was a very strict taqiyya which had to be observed. Now, the first deputy, let's look at the personality of some of the, of all the four deputies, of course. They are not too numerous. So, Abu Amr Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri, he was a resident of Samarra. I don't know whether he was born in Samarra or not. I have not found out. But he was long a resident of Samarra. During the Imam al-Hadi, when he moved to Samarra, he was there. During the whole life of Imam al-Ashari, he was there. And he was in contact with them. And was one of the most reliable wakils of Imam al-Hadi and Imam al-Ashari. So it was quite plausible that after their demise, people could have relied on him as whatever he said. Imam al-Hadi used to say to his companions, that Abu Amr is a trustworthy man, and whatever he tells you is on my behalf. So, he speaks on my behalf. It was Uthman ibn Sa'id who did the ghusl and kafan of Imam al-Askari in public. Now, we believe that the ghusl and kafan of an Imam should be performed by another Imam. And that's why we say that Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam himself was there. But there were two ghusl and kafan. One which was done in secret by Imam, of course, the 5-year-old boy. And the other one, because he was a prominent man of Ahlul Bayt, he was the Imam of the Shia, everyone, of course, respected him. Therefore, he should have had a ghusl and kafan in public. And it was this Abu Amr Uthman ibn Sa'id who did that. And this, of course, shows where he stood in relation to the Imam. He was the head of all the deputies of the 11th Imam. So, just as like a first minister of Imam al-Askari, alayhi salam. He had a great role in convincing the Shias against the other 13 parties that the Imam was Muhammad ibn Hassan, and he had to remain in occultation to protect himself. It was a difficult task, of course, as I said, in the face of all those opposition. If it was not for his position with the 10th and 11th Imam, he could not accomplish this task certainly. Shortly after the demise of the Imam, Al-Amri moved to Baghdad and chose Karak as the place of his headquarters. And he died there before 267. When I say before, it means that we don't know exactly what date he passed away. So, by the deputyship of Uthman, the headquarters of Shia was moved to Baghdad again. There was no point to remain in Samarra anymore. And Baghdad was the place of the whole literary, cultural, and scientific achievements of the Muslim community, and more prominently at scholars were residing there. So there was no point that Amri stayed in Samarra anymore. He was in Samarra because of the Imam. And now that the Imam has passed away, there was no point for him to remain in Samarra, so he moved to Baghdad. And thereafter, all the deputies of the Imam lived and passed away in Baghdad, all of them. So the headquarters of the Shia was in Baghdad at the time. To conceal his underground activities, he used to sell olive oil. And for that he was called Samman or Zayat. Uthman ibn Sa'id as Samman. Sam is oil, and Zayt is also oil. And he did this so skillfully that he received orders from the army for the olive, for the oil provision. So he was a rich man by getting orders from the army, selling oil to them. And certainly if they knew that he is a Shia, they never would have ordered to buy oil from him. So you see how secretly they were keeping the whole state and the whole issue. It's not imaginable to think that the head of a Shia, head of the Shia community, did have a shop which the army thought that this is the best place to buy their provisions from. However, there was another thing. He sold the olive oil to the army, but he used to carry the homes and other trusted materials to the Imam in those big oil jars, which was now returning to him empty, so he used to use that to take them to Imam's house. Probably his business with the army somehow protected him from lots of many suspicions that people might have had about him. And it's really nice to make a film about this. I mean, very interesting. The way these people could keep the secret to this extent, and then be in touch with the whole Shia community, with all the scholars, without anyone knowing what's going on in this shop. Okay. And that they were not coward people, certainly, because otherwise they could have said to everyone, no, don't come close. No, they were very brave people, but at the same time very cautious, very tactful in keeping this secret. The second deputy, Muhammad ibn Uthman ibn Sa'id, this was the first deputy's son. And of course, he was his son, and he was a respected scholar, and he was a respected person by Imam al-Askari as well. Even during the lifetime of Imam al-Askari, he was very respected by him. According to a report, his name was mentioned by Imam al-Askari as the deputy of the 12th Imam. Now that report, because it doesn't have a very strong chain, I didn't want to bring it here, but the report says that Uthman ibn Sa'id is my deputy, and his son is the deputy of al-Mahdi. This is what the report says about Muhammad ibn Uthman. He had the longest period of deputyship, almost 40 years, and he died in 305 and was buried in Baghdad. And this long period tempted some Shia prominent personalities to claim deputyship for themselves. And to prove them wrong, he needed some unusual proofs, like foretelling many events to the knowledge of the Imam, which people asked him about it. Now, this issue of claimant of deputyship, some of them came up because still the outer circle of the Shia community, they did not know who is the Mahdi. And this secret even was not conveyed to the outer circle. And therefore it was very easy to cheat people by saying that I am the Naib of the Imam. And some of them, however, some of these people were really, really prominent Shia scholars. And by that they hoped that they could somehow attract people to themselves has that come? Probably. We don't know what was their intention for claiming deputyship to the Imam. Now, the six people mentioned who claimed deputyship during the time of Muhammad ibn Uthman and his successor Husayn ibn Ruh are Ahmad ibn Hilal al-Adartai, who is called al-Hilali, Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Bilal, Muhammad ibn Nasir al-Numairi. Also the name of Hallaj is mentioned, Husayn ibn Mansur al-Hallaj. This is the famous Hallaj, the mystic, who was executed by the Abbasid government. It's very doubtful really what he claimed. Did he really claim to be a deputy of the Imam? Or he's a very, very type of language, ambiguous language, has led some people to think that he claimed deputyship. Abu Muhammad al-Hasan al-Sari'i and Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Abi al-Azatir al-Shalmahani. Now this Shalmahani is very famous, I'll talk about him later. But as you can imagine, these were not ordinary people. These were certainly scholars, companions of the Imam, al-Hadi and al-Askari alayhim as-salam. They were people who considerably could have attracted attention. And it's unfortunate that such people with that long-standing respect in Shia community came out trying to somehow put themselves in place of a deputy of the Imam. Jealousy or ambition or even sometimes self-deceit. The people thought that I have such a position. What's my difference with Muhammad ibn Uthman? He had been a companion. I have been a companion. Especially about Shalmaghani, he has written many books of hadith from Imam al-Askari and Imam al-Hadi. And even some people, after he claimed to be deputy, they came to Muhammad ibn Uthman and to Husayn ibn Ruh and said, what should we do? Our houses are full of books of Shalmaghani. We used to pray with these books. We used to fast with the help of these books. Now, what should we do? He claims to be a deputy. You say that he's not a deputy. And if he's a liar, should we follow the books that we have been reading from them? Which, of course, the answer came from the Imam alayhi salam that, yes, the books, they reported rightly. They were scholars. They were good people. Suddenly, they have changed. And so, the same thing which was said about the Fatahis, خُذُوا مَا رَوَوْا وَذَرُوا مَا رَأَوْا. Take what they have reported and leave what they believe in. Leave the claims and everything. The latter was one of the most prominent Shia scholars who has compiled several books of hadith. However, he fell out with the third deputy Husayn ibn Ruh and claimed deputyship for himself. Not well, of course we could go into details of why he fell out with Husayn ibn Ruh, what was the dispute, what was the argument. But it's not important, now everything is just a past history. Abu al-Qasim Husayn ibn Nuh. Sorry, should be Husayn ibn Ruh. No Dahti. Now, Nawbakhti, if you remember, I said this book is written by Hassan ibn Musa Nawbakhti. This Ali Nawbakhti family were an Iranian family, quite educated, very clever people, and as soon as they established themselves in Baghdad, they were somehow sought by the Abbasid court because of their expertise, their knowledge. So some of them became wazir, some of them became advisors, but the majority of them, almost all of them were Shia. It was a sort of family faith. And this Husayn ibn Nuh al-Nawbakhti was one of them. So originally he was an Iranian, but of course he had long moved to Baghdad. After Abu Sahl al-Nawbakhti, Abu Sahl al-Nawbakhti is the most prominent of these Nawbakhti. He was the most renowned member of Banu Nawbah family. He was the deputy from 305 to 326. That's for 21 years. Banu Nawbah were a famous Iranian family in Baghdad. After their conversion to Islam, they were taken into the Abbasid court due to their scholarly talent. Some members of this family were appointed as wazirs. Hassan ibn Musa Nawbahti, the great Shiite philosopher and theologian, and Abu Sa'd al-Nawbahti, the great theologian of Baghdad, were from this family. And therefore, Hussein ibn Ruh was not only someone backed by the previous Nawab, designated by them. Now, the task of the second Naib onward was much easier than the task of the first Naib, because they were designated. I mean, on their demise, the Shia scholars came together and they designated who is my successor under, of course, orders of the Imam alayhi salam, who's going to be the Naib after me. So it was very easy. It was the most important and difficult task was for the first deputy to establish himself as a deputy. Hussein ibn Ruh was a wakil of Muhammad ibn Uthman in Baghdad, along with 9 other persons. Muhammad ibn Uthman, who was the second deputy. However, he was chosen by the Imam as the deputy after Muhammad ibn Uthman. He was both a theologian and a jurist, and was one of the cleverest and wisest scholars of his time. He died in Baghdad in 326 and was buried in the Nawbakhtiya area. Of course, you cannot find Nawbakhtiya area in Baghdad now. The fourth deputy, Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samuri. He was a companion of Imam al-Askari and was chosen by the Imam as a deputy in 326. He was in the post for 3 years. Certainly, of course, the more we come forward, the older these companions of Imam al-Askari will become. And therefore, he lived only 3 years. And it was probably not possible otherwise for Imam al-Mahdi al-Islam to choose a deputy who was not a companion of his father. So you will see that all his deputies were companions of his father and of his grandfather, as in the case of the first two. He passed away in the year 329, which was called the year of Tanafur al-Nujum. Yes, 329 was the most bitter year for the Shia, because many bitter things happened. The Imam went into complete occultation. That was the first very bitter thing in 329. Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samuri, the head of the Shia, passed away. Khulaini, the most prominent Shia scholar, passed away. Ali ibn Babway, father of Shaykh al-Sadr, passed away, along with some other scholars. And so this is called the year where the stars went, the stars scattered out and disappeared. The year of the disappearance of the stars, Tanasur al-Nujum. And, of course, he was buried in Baghdad. So remember this 329, which is the most bitter year for the Shia after the Imam alayhi salam. 6 days before his death, he received a tawqi'. Now, you know what tawqi' is now. From the Imam. Now, what was the tawqi'? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ya Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samuri. أعظم الله أجر إخوانك فيك فإنك ميت ما بينك وبين ستة أيام. O Ali ibn Muhammad al-Samuri, may Allah increase the reward of your brethren in you. That means you are going to die, your brothers are going to be rewarded by God for their patience. May Allah give them abundant reward. For you will die within 6 days, therefore prepare. But do not make a will for anyone to take your place after you. The second occultation is now taking place. Now, of course, at that time, it was not said minor occultation, major occultation. It was said first occultation and second occultation. That's why the Imam says, فَقَدْ وَقَعَتِ الْغَيْبَةُ الثَّانِيَةِ. Now the second ghaiba has taken place. There will be no appearance except after the permission of God. فَلَا ظُهُورَ إِلَّا بَعْدَ إِذْنِ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ. And this will be after long time, and hardening of the heart and the spread of injustice. Some of my Shia will come and claim seeing me. Beware whoever claims seeing me before the advent of Sufyani and the Sayha. These are the two signs of the advent of the Imam, which we'll discuss later, is a liar. Now this statement, of course, this is the most famous statement of the second occultation by the Imam alayhi salam. At the end there is something very, very important, and that's why we are confused about it. People say that we have seen the Imam. Here Imam says, whoever claims that has seen me is a liar. Some of my Shia will come and claim seeing me. Beware. Whoever claims seeing me before the advent of Sufyani and the Sayha is a liar. Now, the scholars have hard time to make conciliation between this statement and the statement of some of the most trusted people who say that we have seen them. And that's why they have, some of them have said that they have talked. It's not possible. Imam says whoever claims, we respect these scholars. If we do not respect them, we say they are liars. But since we respect them, we say that they have talked, that they are seen the Imam. However, some others have been more respectful to some of those scholars or spiritual people who have said that they have seen the Imam. They say that when Imam mentions this, he wants to uproot the claim of deputation after him. So anyone coming claiming that he is in contact with me, he is mediating between me and the people, he brings messages from me. That is very interesting, because now there are many people in Iran who claim that they are in contact, and they bring messages from Imam to people. That's very interesting. I don't know whether you have seen the film or not, that one of such people claimed that the Imam actually comes and leads them in prayer. And therefore, if you see the film, it's very funny. They all stand in a line and there is an empty sajada in the front, and then they pray. And the man who claims that he sees the Imam, he says that yes, he's down in Ruku, Allahu Akbar, go to Ruku, Allahu Akbar, go to Sujood. He sees them going to Ruku and Sujood and others don't see him. Now it's very interesting. So, this portal claims that people can see him and mediate between him and the people, or can bring a message from him. I mean, these messages were not easy to get from the Imam. Even at the time of the minor occultation, you had to wait for a long time to get a response from the Imam. Long time in the sense that you had to take your letter, get it to the Naib, and sometimes, of course, the response came immediately. Sometimes there was a long time they had to wait. However, these claims that people sometimes made, that they bring messages from the Imam to other people, Imam said that, certainly, absolutely, they lie. Now, I don't know, because there are some reports from reliable people. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. One of those 14. Now, what to do? But to be on the safe side, we do not believe anything as a message from Imam alayhi salam, or that Imam said to do this. Imam said, when is he going to come? Well, this is very clear, because he himself doesn't know when he's going to come, according to all those traditions that we learn. Or, for example, Imam said, you do this so that I come earlier. Again, people claim that we saw the Imam and the Imam said, do it such and such so that my faraj comes closer. Anyone, we do not deny now, okay, we do not deny that people may see the Imam. And usually it happens that when they see the Imam, they do not recognize him. Afterwards, they think that he was the Imam. But even if that is the case, no exchange of messages from the Imam to people or from the people to the Imam. So, At the end, this is the last, of course, the last tawqi, the last sentence from Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, that وَسَيَعْتِ شِيَعَتِي مَنْ شِيَعَتِ. So he of course admits that these are from the Shia who claimed it. وَسَيَعْتِ شِيَعَتِي مَنْ يَدَّعِي الْمُشَاهَدَةِ. Mushahada means just seeing. This is very clear. From among my Shia will come those who claim that they see. أَلَا فَمَنِ ادَّعَ الْمُشَاهَدَ قَبْلَ خُرُوجِ السُّفْيَانِ وَالسَّيْفَ فَهُوَ كَاذِبٌ مُفْتَرٌ. He makes lies. Whoever believes in that, وَلَا حَوْلَ وَلَا قُوَّةَ إِلَّا بِاللَّهِ الْعَلِيِّ الْعَظِيمِ. This is in Kamal al-Din of Saduq. Questions? So we are done with the minor occultation, then inshallah we move to, of course, major occultation has nothing to say. We are living in a major occultation, so we move to the signs of the zuhur, reappearance, inshallah.
You mentioned in your talk that you will need common scholars on the same deputyship, and that you mentioned one of the revision books and things like that, and you mentioned some of the reasons that might have led them to do this, and then you mentioned very quickly. The thing that comes to my mind is that this problem is not just related to the time of the Imam of the petition. It is also possible in our time that we could have scholars, not forget, or common. They've done a lot of work. And for various reasons might then do things that might not necessarily be right. So how do we deal with that? You know, this idea of that we cannot be somehow in fact, because at the end of the day, in your position of the Imam, if you are, you have no way of absolute authority of information. If you suspect that there is something there. I'm not talking about minor issues, I'm talking about major issues. Sometimes you think that, are we on the right path, or is this the way forward? You know, and I'm just an ordinary person, I'm not a scholar, so I can just characterize these sort of issues that sometimes got me on my mind, and I don't really, you know, to understand what I'm
saying. Yeah, to always follow the right path. Of course, we need good scholars to guide us to the right path. But we have to have some sort of judicious mind ourselves as well to find out if someone is saying something, it is according to, first of all, standards of intellect and reason and sound understanding, and secondly, is there a good evidence for what they say from the Hadith, from the Quran? And for this reason, I think the Shia community should be quite a lively community. The scholars should be able to discuss things with each other. If a scholar comes out and claims something, other scholars are there to certainly say, okay, what is your evidence? And why are you saying this? Why are you claiming this? And it's for the public to always listen to all these evidence and these different views and choose what is the best. Of course, I mean, if there is a talented person who wants to misguide, he can really, really just create a destruction and may really misguide many people. This has happened during the course of history. So, you really have to seek refuge to God, not to be misguided. Yeah.
Early days of Imam Ali Salam, it was very confusing. Only the first book even given that he was born, nothing else to do. What was the situation of these people that are ordinary people? Where were they confused? What would they have done? Because they, you know, they clearly have to know where I am, but they're lost.
Yeah. Usually the people refer to the scholars, certainly. I mean, as in many other issues, that the people all around the Muslim world where there were Shias, there were scholars, people usually refer to those scholars, asking them, okay, what is our duty now, who's the Imam? The important thing was to convince the scholars, not the lay people. Because lay people, of course, it was very difficult to somehow reach out to all of them. And the important job which these Nawab did, they convinced the majority of the scholars, if we don't say all of them, that they were the Nawab, the Imam was born, the Imam is in hiding, and after they were convinced, they conveyed the message to the people, and people followed them. And that's why we are here now. I mean, we are standing in this very firm position with regard to the Imam.
Finally, there's one hadith
No, waqaf means someone who determines a time for the appearance of the Imam. Is that what you mean?
Yes, so is that more specific, or to mention anyone who says they have Imam, see Imam?
Well, that is not included in this hadith, but we have the other hadith, which the Imam said, alayhi salam, very clearly, that whoever claims mushahada, he's a liar. So, waqat is different from someone who claims mushahada. Someone might say, I have not seen the Imam, but I know where the Imam is coming from.
And who actually said this and is that
I'm not sure. This is reported from Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam as well, but I'm not sure about the chain and the source.
I was just wondering, because the last topic that you cited came to the whole testimony before the passage. And you very well said that the ulama were very intelligent, did not accept anything from anybody. They wanted evidence to see the reply comes in the handwriting of the ulama. Is there any documentation in circulation available for us at this time to see yes?
No. Because you would not expect that these type of writings would have somehow remained. Because they were very secret type of writings, they were kept very secretly, and they were lost. I mean, there were earthquakes, people dying, not telling others where the letter is. So, we just have the report of them in the book. We don't have the original letters or papers or something.
So you can see that people were confused then, where they could see the evidence or indeed that somebody said it behind at this stage. But we can have a judicious mind and think how this very sad, most of all things are unhappy. Not that I'm disputing the idea, but we do not have something. It's so sad that our Shia that seems to have lost majority, but not all the evidence.
No, for example, do you have a copy of the Quran written at the time of the Prophet? You don't have it. I mean, you don't need to have that first-hand copy all the time to say, yes, this is the copy written at the time of the Prophet, so we compare it to it. It is transferred to other copies, those are transferred to other copies, and this is how the knowledge actually carries on to go through the channel of time. Therefore, here we have the same thing as well. We don't need that original letter. It's what is encoded for us. And even if you see that original letter, how do you know that this is the letter written by Imam al-Askari or Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam? You don't know what their handwriting, the people who knew the handwriting are there. And so you don't. It is more convincing to see Saduq saying that this was the handwriting written. This is what was written in the handwriting. I confirm it, I accept it. Because my father, for example, has authorized this hadith, and his shaykh has authorized it. It's more convincing just to have that piece of letter with us, not knowing where has it come from, what's the origin. So, I think, no, we have good evidence now. I mean, we cannot really compare ourselves with the Shia of that time. We are in a very, very, much better position in terms of certainty, knowledge, comprehensiveness of what the Imam said, which was just scattered at that time. people did not dare to publish, did not dare to open the saying. So we have a very better understanding, I think, at this point.
Thank you,
sister.
Thank you very
much for your attention. In the context of meeting the Imam, you mentioned at the end of the lecture, there's two aspects that I was wondering to ask you about. One is, I've heard someone once mention that they told the Imam in a dream, and they got direction or advice. Is that something that we can access? Because this is quite fitting with the meeting
of the Imam. Yeah, this is not, of course, the case of meeting. This is just a dream, and dreams might be right or wrong. Now, some people say that you cannot see. When, if you see someone in your dream and you think that he's the prophet or the Imam, he's of course, isn't it? Because otherwise you haven't seen them to compare to see whether what we have seen is the Imam or not. It's our thoughts, something which comes from an unknown consciousness in the dream that yes, I've met Imam al-Asr, I met the Prophet. Then the hadith which says that whoever meets me in the dream has really met me, because shaitan cannot somehow make himself in my face or something like that. This hadith of course is rejected by Sayyid Murtaza and Sheikh Mufid and others. They say this is not a reliable hadith, and therefore it's possible that people, not shaitan coming actually, people may see someone in a dream, they may think that this is the Imam or the Prophet, but their thought is wrong. It's possible. However, there's other possibilities that yes, really what you see in the dream might be a message coming from the Prophet or from the Imam, and you have seen a face which is very similar to their faith. It's possible, but who can rely on a dream? I mean, it's only convincing for yourself if you see in the dream. No one else can really rely on the dream of other people, because this dream business is very, very vague. Sometimes the origin is quite unknown. Sometimes the messages come to you, it means something else, you see, because the dream is a business of images coming, images having different meanings than what you see. So it needs an interpreter. Even what is said needs an interpreter to interpret. So, but it's possible, yeah. Certainly it's possible.
And the other aspect, and I'm just looking in here, I thought there was some mechanism whereby people believe the messages go to Tamara for a number of days, do some hard for the day, and end up meeting the Imam. Is that not correct?
I hope so. You can try.
It's not something that is well known as a process.
It's not something that our scholars practice. That's what I mean. Not something that our scholars practice. And even, I mean, it might be something. I mean, you might, for 40 days, for example, or more than that, for a couple of months, 3 months, you go do some very, very long, for example, worship or something, and after 40 days or that, you just see someone, you think, oh, he's the Imam. Or, but what's the use of it? He's not going to tell you anything. He's not going to give you any guidance, any message. If it is, it's good. I do not deny, I do not want to dissuade anyone to doing, for doing this, and inshallah it will work. But we can do better things with that 40 days, certainly.
Not all share, and that will mean that that was case, the
Yeah, Hussein al-Mansur, many people say that he was a Shia, yes, and some people say he was killed because he was a Shia, but these people who claimed deputyship, all of them were Shia. Because how could you claim to be deputy of an imam while you don't have a standing in the Shia community? So they had a position in the Shia community, that's why they could put forward the claim. And especially with the case of Shalmaghani, he was very prominent. Someone in the level of Hussein ibn Ruh, not less than him, certainly. And that's why he dared to claim, while Hussein ibn Ruh was there as the Naib, he dared to claim that I am the Naib. Therefore, they were all Shia. About the, of course, the two deputies, yes, there's no doubt, certainly they were Shia. How could they not be Shia? You have read it somewhere, or? Yeah. If this is the case, this even shows they were even more clever than we thought. That people thought they were Sunnis and they were deputies of the Imam. That shows how clever they could conceal all the issues. Yeah, there is one question here, sir.
Okay,
let me
just a question. You mentioned that the ritual copy was done in private and in public. Who led the prayer in the Salam?
In public or in private? In private, Imam Mahdi led the prayer, even when he was 5 years old. Just like, for example, Yahya alayhi salam, where we are told in the Quran, "Atayna al-Hukma Sabiya." In public, it was the caliph who should have, of course, led the prayer. I'm not sure now about who led the prayer in public, whether it was Ja'far or he was the caliph. I'm not sure now.